My name is Lee Tran, and I'm the author of the memoir, House of Sticks.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you for coming on today, Lee. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to
Thank
you?
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Oh, sorry.
It's my pleasure to have you here. It's really an honor.
That's such an interesting question, because I think for a large portion of my life, I've tried to ask myself that very question, because I am actually 7/8 Tiêu Châu. I was born in Vietnam, but I'm 7/8 Tiêu Châu. And, you know, my book explores a lot of what identity even means, especially, you know, these superficial markers of identity. And for me, I guess I've tried to peel back the layers of identity and just discover what it means to be human first and foremost, and then go from there. But in terms of what it means to be Vietnamese, I think it is something that has really defined my experience, especially being a Vietnamese refugee. My father was a former prisoner of war who fought on the South Side during the war. So, you know, that has really impacted our entire existence, and the intergenerational trauma that he suffered, which, you know, can't quite be extricated from our experience of being human.
Can we talk a little bit about the subject of being Tiêu Châu? Because that's not really discussed much. You don't hear a lot about it in, you know, Vietnamese media or Vietnamese American media, or there's not a whole lot of discussion of who those people were. And I can say that because my family, my great grandfather is also from 100% from that culture. So, but I'm like an eighth, but yeah. You're 7/8 of it. And can we talk a little bit about like who they are and what they were doing in Vietnam? And
yeah, I mean, my grandparents immigrated from China. So they were born in China, and, you know, just to escape the tribal warfare that was happening at the time, in the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. And so they came over, and, you know, a lot of them settled in South Vietnamese regions, like Vinh Long, Sóc Trăng, and those areas. And they often, you know, experience a lot of discrimination. And so my parents growing up experienced a lot of, you know, they were being called a lot of racial slurs and being made fun of for speaking Tiêu Châu. And so it's interesting because they experienced discrimination in Vietnam, and then coming over to America, our entire family experienced discrimination just for being Asian. And so it's just like, just suffering from oppression for a very long time. It's in our history.
And you know what's crazy? As I reflect on one of the stories in your book about your father being on the firing line for escaping, right? Was it like two guys?
Yeah.
One guy to the right getting shot dead, and he's the only guy. I wonder if during that moment or after that moment, if there's any reflection going, wait a minute, not really from Vietnam. And I am like on the firing line being put to death because I was in the South Vietnamese army. Did he ever talk about that at all?
No, I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure it was on his mind, because he often likes to remind us, oh, we're Chinese, you know, with Tiêu Châu. And then so when I tried to ask him about the Vietnamese identity, I mean, he's still very proud of his country. He's proud of, you know, having served his country, but also, you know, there are a lot of complicated feelings there, as you can imagine. So I don't know. That's a good question. I would love to really like pick his brain a little bit more, but obviously it's also a touchy subject.
Yeah. Borders are bullshit though, right?
Yeah.
Country borders are just. Oh,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's all arbitrary. It's all human made.
So conscious.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I read that, I was like, How scary was it to be your father? I mean, to really survive that situation. It's just so lucky.
In many ways, he was fortunate, but obviously in many ways, he was unfortunate. You know, he was drafted into the war. He was only 16, served for a time as a lieutenant, and then had to serve he served 7 years in the actual re-education camps. And was emaciated. The prisoners were fed, you know, a portion of a potato every day. And that was all they had to eat. A lot of prisoners died of, you know, malnutrition and disease. And, you know, he almost died for escaping or having this plan to escape with his two comrades, I suppose, or friends.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's scary enough for him to suffer still from daily nightmares.
And then I have friends or people that ask me, you know, when will our stories of this trauma and this war, when will we stop talking about that and move on? And I'd like to ask you, like, do you have fatigue talking about this? Because sometimes I get fatigued hearing about this over and over daily, right? And editing it and just hearing the stories. And sometimes I want to evolve the podcast into like newer subjects, but we're here. We're still lingering here. And there's more writer of your caliber coming out, you know, monthly. We see like new writers coming out with high quality books that are talking about the trauma and the war and coming out and growing from, you know, the last 45, 50 years of this American life. You know, do you think that it's close to the time that we're going to evolve out of this subject, or how much longer are we needing to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember what happened to us so that we can learn from the mistakes that were made in history and learn not to repeat them. But I'm really, you know, part of my story, a lot of it is talking about the war, but it also talks about how to heal from that trauma. And so I do think that we are in a time of deep healing, and it's not going to be overnight that we heal from this, obviously. I think healing is just an ongoing journey. But I'm really glad to see, you know, that the story is no longer a single story, and it's not presented from a Western perspective, you know, where these stories are now ours to own and to tell. And I'm glad that we are given the platform to do so.
Yeah. And I am also really happy is not the word, but to have read a modern story about a young girl who needed glasses, right? Who couldn't see. And, you know, that excited me because that's a modern day problem. Didn't have to be it wasn't like really an immigrant. Well, it was related because her father was like, no, we're not doing that. But it just was a modern problem. And here in modern real life, I mean, that happened to you, that was so, it was delightful to read about it and to see how, you know, it was just so heartwarming to me to read that part of that, of your story.
Oh, thank you so much. That really means a lot to me, because growing up, you know, I didn't think that my story was believable because I didn't see myself represented in literature, in the media. I didn't see these types of problems being talked about. And so I hid my problem for a very long time from the adults around me. I didn't think anybody would believe it. And it took me a long time to even come to terms with what had actually happened and to put words on the paper. And so, you know, I think one of my primary motivations for writing this story is so that, you know, if there is another little girl, another little boy out there who is suffering from a similar issue, that they can see themselves represented, you know, and they won't have to feel so alone.
How long were you in that world for, the blind world, like unable to see?
Oh gosh, for too long. But I think it was, I mean, you know, I was sent home in the third grade with a note from the nurse saying that I needed glasses. So, but you know, it must have started in the second grade, maybe, you know, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
What you couldn't see, right?
Yeah. Especially if I just thought, though, this is normal. You know, it's when you're so young, you don't know what's normal and what's not normal. Like somebody needs to tell you, if you're squinting, it's the responsibility of adults around you to see that and say, maybe this child needs glasses, right? And so it was in the third grade when I received that letter, and I couldn't see from the third grade to, I guess, my first year of college. So I don't know. That's about 10 years, a decade of just nearsightedness.
Whoa.
And, you know, obviously it progressed, right? So in the third grade, I was still able to see the board in school if I sat in the front row. And then by middle school, I was starting to really not be able to see anything. In high school, forget about it. I couldn't see anything, even if it was directly in front of me.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't even see myself in the mirror, which presented like a whole different set of psychological issues. It does something to you when you're unable to really see who you are and see how you even age throughout the years.
I just can't imagine going 10 years and it getting progressively worse, your eyesight. So how do you think your life changed can you describe how your life changed once you put glasses on?
Well, you know, I put glasses on. So it was a teacher in the ninth grade, Mr. DeChunkett. He was actually an eighth grade teacher of mine. He taught me chess. And a friend of mine who had gone to the same high school as me, he told my teacher, you know, hey, Lee has a really hard time seeing and she's not telling anybody. And so that teacher reached out to me and said, hey, like, if you need help, I will purchase you a pair of glasses. And so, you know, I was really nervous. I thought I was betraying my parents, but at the same time, really wanted to do well in school. And so I went with him, and it seemed like this really like shady thing that I was doing, even though he was just getting me a pair of glasses. And so I would bring this pair of glasses. I was so grateful when I first put on glasses. I just seeing the leaves on the trees. I mean, what an incredible experience. I was like, oh my God, this is what trees look like. I had forgotten, you know? But there was just so much guilt within me that I took the glasses off immediately and I swore to myself, I'll only use these glasses when it's like, when I'm desperate, when I really, really need to see. So I would go to school, hide the glasses, put them on for a second to see notes and then try to memorize what I saw. But eventually my eyesight just deteriorated. You know, I think 6 months after receiving those glasses, my eyesight, my vision, or my prescription rather, changed. And so things started to get blurry again. I started to get debilitating headaches again. And I was just too ashamed of myself to even reach out to my teacher to ask for help again, or to even, you know, keep him abreast of the situation. And so I think by the 10th grade, those glasses were useless. And I just didn't want to tell anybody. I thought the issue was me. I clearly, you know, something was wrong with me and I didn't want to trouble anybody anymore.
And you talk about a book that you read.
Well, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison.
The Bluest Eyes. I should know that. When did you read that book?
So I read that in the 10th grade, I believe. And oh my gosh, you know, this entire time I'm an avid reader and I'm just searching for myself within the pages. And, you know, I could read because I could hold the book very close to my eyes and just read that way. And it wasn't until I read The Bluest Eye that I finally realized how powerful representation is. Now, The Bluest Eye is a book about a little Black girl who yearns for a new pair of eyes. You know, she thinks that if she can somehow get a hold of blue eyes, it would make her worthy as a human being. And here I am, a little girl yearning for a new pair of eyes, albeit for very different reasons, right. But I was trying to define my humanity and trying to see my worth. And when I read that book, it was the first book to make me cry. And I just remember thinking to myself, oh my goodness, I hope that one day I have the power to move somebody to tears. Like, I hope that one day I have the power to tell my story, and for somebody else to recognize themselves within my pages. And so that was sort of like when the seed was planted of potentially becoming a writer.
And did you actively pursue this for the next umpteen years, or did you have a discussion with your parents and they're like, no. How did it go down?
That's a good question. Actually, you know, in high school, so I went to the Bronx High School of Science, very scientific, math oriented. But unfortunately, science and math are subjects in which you really need to be able to see the board in order to do well in, right? So I started to do really, I mean, I failed almost all my classes, or I almost failed all my classes, rather. And English was really the only class that I was able to listen. I could hold the book up to my eyes, read the books on my own time, and then in class, we barely had to take notes. It was just discussion based. So I started to do really well in English. So it was almost as if life kind of placed me on this trajectory towards becoming a writer. You know, I somehow miraculously made it to college, and it was in college that my oldest brother, you know, during this whole time, he's away at college. He's not really aware of what's going on at home. But when he comes back from college and realizes, oh my goodness, like Lee still can't see, as a gift, he purchased me a pair of contacts and said, here, like this way, mom and dad won't be able to tell that you're wearing glasses, you know, like use this in your first year of college to do better. And, you know, so I'm in my first year of college and I get a 4.0, and I decide to major in on a pre-med track in neuroscience because I'm really fascinated by like how the brain works. You know, there's mental illness, mental health is a big theme in my memoir, for obvious reasons. You know, not just the PTSD that my father suffered from, but also the debilitating depression that I suffered from not being able to see for a decade. And being told that my experiences, my perception of reality was incorrect. And so I'm majoring in neuroscience, but I don't do very well. I start to slip because I feel like I'm betraying my parents. I feel like I don't deserve the success that I had in my first year of college. So I almost, it was, you know, an act of self-sabotage. I stopped going to classes. I become really just I spiral into my a dark depression, and eventually I dropped out of school. Yeah, so my path towards becoming a writer was really, you know, it didn't start with writing. It started with science and then neuroscience, and then when I dropped out, I met somebody who convinced me to reapply to school, and I thought, oh my goodness, there's what school will accept me with a 2.0 GPA. You know, I failed all of my classes. And she said, you know, just try, what's the worst that can happen? The schools reject you and you're still, nothing worse can happen, right? And out of the, I believe I applied to about 8 to 10 schools. And out of those schools, only one school accepted me. And they accepted me on the strength of my essay. They said, you know, we weren't going to accept you. Your grades, you know, are not great, but we decided to give you a chance because your essay was really special. So if you haven't considered majoring in writing, we recommend that you know, advise that you check it out. And so,
What a weird turn of events to become a writer.
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, yeah.
It's mind bending to think about.
Right. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know if this, maybe it's just the way that I was raised. I was raised Buddhist. But I'm also a deeply spiritual person. And so sometimes I think about all the events in my life that have led me to where I am today. And when you look back, it almost seems like all the dots connect, you know, to present this very complex tapestry of a life.
Fascinating. Now, during these years, you also have a lot of experience working as a nail tech in these nail salons, right?
Right.
I I have a weird question. I think about this quite a bit. I am addicted to watching fights, whether it's UFC sanctioned fights or, you know, world star or something star, gang fights, or, you know, just random street fights online. Yeah. And sometimes when I watch the nail fights inside of nail salons that are captured on video, it's heartbreaking because obviously it's our people, and it's just heart-wrenching. And I know that you've spent time, and I'm sure that you've come across a lot of that kind of physical conflict or people not paying and just getting up and leaving. On the one hand, I have to separate myself from the enjoyment of watching fights, but at the same time, being very mindful that this is a painful situation for somebody on the nail side. But do you sometimes look at these things, or during the experience of it, think about, like, sometimes the fights or the disputes come from within our community, because we are talking shit oftentimes, right? We are talking shit about other people. And I can say this because, you know, I have a lot of family all Vietnamese people have family in the nail business. And you just know going in, because we've all spent time in nail salons, and you just know that a lot of shit talking happens on the side of the nail tech. So that energy, I think, sometimes pervade the salon, and it transfers over, and we're not recognizing or cognizant of our behavior. But what's your idea? What's your thoughts on all of that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I worked primarily with my mother in a nail salon that she bought, and it was oftentimes just me and her. And my mother, she taught me never to trash talk anybody. She's always teaching me to actively practice kindness and compassion for others. And so on the one hand, I totally can see how people, I mean, it's just like, it's sort of embedded in our culture. It's very toxic, actually. And it sort of harkens back to this idea that, like, hurt people, right? So we're coming from a position of being oppressed, and, you know, we're sort of emulating that same form of oppression sometimes, and which is problematic, and it's something that should be talked about. And I think a lot of these fights can be prevented if there was more of an open line of communication, right? And you know, just people learning to love one another, which seems, it's like, that's seems easy enough, but
yeah, but it's complicated. It's complex.
Yeah. And there's always, like, there's this sort of, like, us versus them mentality, yeah, oftentimes. But, you know, that said, my working in the nail salon with my mother was a really traumatic time for me, because of how a lot of our clients, the way that they treated my mother for not being able to speak English properly. And so, you know, here I am, I grew up in America, you know, I came here at the age of 3, I can speak perfect English. And I'm working alongside my mother and seeing her struggle to speak to clients, and seeing these clients degrade her and yeah, you know, say things to her that no child should ever hear. And I'm trying to translate, you know, and so I'm trying to, in a way, preserve my mother's ignorance. And telling her, because she can't, she doesn't understand the insults that are being hurled at her, and I can understand. So I absorb all those insults for her, but I don't let her know, you know? And so that was a really interesting time for me growing up, and trying to navigate these really, many times dangerous and toxic places, and navigate, you know, these people treating my mother in a way that robs her of her humanity simply because she's in a position of service, right? Be experiencing that myself.
And this is going on daily, moment to moment, every day across this country. The yeah, insults, but it's not entirely a one-way street too. You know, like you right, said, hurt people. And so I think there's this dynamic of, it's a hotbed of, you know, just bacterial infection that is, you know, culturally going both ways constantly, where, you know, some communities are rougher than other communities, some neighborhoods, some salons are placed in, you know, difficult communities. And, you know, there's this buildup of all of this miscommunication and toxicity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I hope that we can evolve from that. You know, I hope that we can see that we're fighting on the same side. You know, we're the same, we're all the same. And the sooner that we can realize that, the sooner that we can, you know, open our arms wide and welcome one another in a healthier space, not these spaces where, like, you know, there's just, it's a breeding ground for hostility and animosity towards one another.
Yes. And it's very difficult to kind of have our community understand that, you know, there's probably better ways, but with better ways comes a lot of discipline and learning and reprogramming and restructuring the way we think about other cultures.
Yes. You know?
And it's not an easy task when every day you're confronted with this energy of, like, the other, right? Like these others, and you, in your mind, you're thinking that you're right. And it's so, that deprogramming would take, I don't have a lot of hope for it sometimes, because I just know some of my family members are just like, they're thick, they're dense, and they just don't want to change. And they think that they're there and they're right all the time. And it's just like the other people are the wrong people. Yeah, I don't want to dwell on this, but it is a point of contention culturally that I think that not often talked about. We see the videos that it shows up online in the news and stuff like that, but
heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, but I think you're doing an incredible job just even, like, opening up the conversation and saying, hey, this is an issue. We have to talk about this, you know? And I think, you know, the more that we can have these open conversations, like there is hope. As bleak as it may seem sometimes, I think there more and more, we see every day more and more people being open to having these conversations, especially in the younger generation.
But that's the key, right?
Exactly.
That's the key. It's the younger generation. And what does it all boil down to? It's all words. It's all, like, communication. It's same in the political sphere, I think. Nail shops, political sphere. It's all because there is a language problem. There is an inability to understand fully what the other person is saying. And you get this sort of, like, misinformation, or you get this, like, weird communication with you and the client, and all hell breaks loose because of our assumptions of what the other person is thinking.
Right, exactly. And also, what are we doing to, like, what energy are we putting forth to attract that, right? You know, if we're sitting in a nail salon and trash talking somebody else, right? It's like, and then we want to pick fights, like, oh, you know, why are they treating us this way? Well, we kind of had it coming.
No, it's true. It's so true.
Yeah.
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 I have family who are half Salvadorian, half Vietnamese, and they look, and, you know, some of the guys have, like, bald, shaved heads. They look like gangsters. They'll roll in with their Latino girlfriends into a Vietnamese nail shop, and, like, the older ones speak fluent Vietnamese. And you might not look like, and they'll come back and they'll tell me, like, this is what happened in nail salon. You know, over the years, it's constantly telling me these funny stories about what these women would say. And it goes both ways. So we have to find a way to change it. It should be taught at the beauty schools too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, like, I feel like within the culture, Vietnamese people talk shit about Vietnamese people. So that's also an issue, you know, it's like, just stop talking trash about other people. It's like, and so, like, we've got to fix it within us. And then, you know, and maybe then we'll decide not to do it for other people as well. But
yeah,
it's definitely a pervasive problem.
Yes. Let's switch up the direction a little bit about discipline. You've talked about you know, your writing career has not been a straight line. And it's not like, you know, you were at the writing table every day at 5 a.m. in the morning and you're just cranking out pages. That's not the way this artist life works. And what I've learned through sitting in this chair, talking to a lot of writers and artists is it, like a book, I think on average, what it seems like to me is on average from when you start kind of getting the tingly fingers till the day you get it to a publisher, takes about 8 to 10 years. Sometimes it's 6 years, but it's like the average is 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
That is a phenomenal amount of strength of a human being to stick with something that long. Can you tell me about the journey of that time that, you know, it wasn't a straight shot for you?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it was definitely, even once I got into college, when I, you know, reapplied to college and was given a second chance, I tried writing, and I majored in fiction actually. And I was, you know, I didn't really have too many hopes. I just thought, oh, let me major in this. Hopefully I do well. Hopefully I don't drop out again this time. You know, and I thought, so a lot of the stories that I came to class with were sort of loosely based on my life. And, you know, my second to last year in college, I realized I didn't have enough credits to graduate. So I took an outside course during the summer at NYU. It's a course called Writers in New York, where you get to study with like actual writers. And so I applied to the fiction department of the program. And I quickly realized that it wasn't for me. And so I just asked the director of the program, like, is there room in like another department? And she said, well, you know, there's nonfiction. You could just, there's still space. So why don't you hop over there? And so I did. And there I met Saeed Serafizadeh, who is an incredible memoirist, and not just an incredible memoirist, but an incredible professor. And he was just so engaged, and he clearly loved the craft. He loved talking about it. He loved teaching it. And I thought, oh, you know, why don't I just, you know, reach out to him and email him some of what I was working on. I was going to Columbia at the time. So what I was working on at Columbia. And he responded. He said, sorry, you know, this is not a workshop. It's a seminar. And so I won't be able to read these pages, but why don't you come to my office hours and we'll discuss your goals as a writer.
Wow.
And so I thought, okay, yeah, sure. I'll take that. And so I meet with him and I tell him that I'm hoping to one day write a book that's loosely based on my life. And he said, what's so special about your life? You know, why do you think it warrants an entire book? And I tell him, you know, well, I'm a refugee, came here when I was 3. I did sweatshop labor as a child. And I was doing nail salon work at the age of 12 and onward. I couldn't see all these things, you know, basically my memoir in a nutshell. And he says, wow, like Lee, this is an incredible story. You should, you know, go with it. I think you've got something really special. And so I go home. That was really incredible feedback. I was so motivated to work on this. And the next week, his agent emails me and says, dear Lee, your professor Saeed, who we represent, forwarded us your pages. Here's a contract. We would love to represent you. And so I was like, wait, what? First of all, I was so green that I didn't even know what an agent was. I thought it was a scam. I was like, what is going on? I quickly reached out to Saeed, and he's like, no, I ended up reading your pages after our meeting, and I thought this was great. And yeah.
Okay. So let's stop right here. Cause I have another question that I wrote down like much later in the interview.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's a lot of people that write that don't get published, and you know, to get that sort of chance, right? You're not even done with school yet. You're not even out. Yeah. You haven't even produced anything yet.
Yeah. And nor was I really even thinking of like, you know, what my career would be. I was just like, I'm just trying to not drop out of school. That's all I was. Yeah.
Man, this road in life, whatever you choose to do, there's so much that people don't talk about that have to do with luck.
Absolutely. And I can attest to that because I obviously I feel like I've been very unfortunate in my life, but I'm also incredibly fortunate. You know, the people that I've met along the way, I mean, they're responsible for a lot of my success today. And I'm so grateful to Saeed for just passing my pages along to his agent and making that connection. I meet up with his agent's co-agent. Her name is Sarah. And, you know, she tells me this is going to be a memoir, not a novel, because it's a real story. So why would you, it would mean a lot to people if it were depicted as a true story. And so I said, sure. And I asked if she could wait for me to graduate, because I had 1 year left and I didn't want to derail my focus. I didn't want the past to repeat itself. And then as soon as I graduated, she emailed me. She said, let's get to work.
Wow.
So, and I said, okay, like, what do we do? And she's like, well, let's work on a proposal. The great thing about nonfiction in the publishing industry is that you don't need a full manuscript to sell the rights to your manuscript. You just need a proposal. So a sort of synopsis of the story you're going to tell, a breakdown of chapters, all these things. And so we work on that together for about 6 months. So from May to November. So in November, 6 months after I graduate, I received my book deal. That in and of itself was an incredible journey.
Okay, so you get the book deal, you sign the ink and it dries. And yes. How long from that point to when you finally get it finished and ready and it's on the bookshelves?
Oh, okay. So 2014, December of 2014 is when I signed the book deal. I signed the contract, and then the final manuscript is accepted in June of 2020. So that's, yeah. And then from there, from June, then you've got like the whole copy editing, you've got a line by line editing, all the grammar has to be, correct. Then you've got to prepare, you've got to choose a cover, you've got to ask other authors for blurbs. And then you've got to publicize the book. So get it, get some buzz generated around it. And then I was published in June of 2021.
Oh my God. That's 7 years.
Yeah, exactly. 7 years overall.
Now, that means that whoever your agent or the people that are involved in backing you up, they have to have extreme tenacity as well, right?
Oh my goodness. My agent is a shark. I love her. I really, really love her. But she, oh gosh, she's not somebody you want to cross, basically, because she's, really focused. She knows exactly what she's doing. And, she really negotiated an incredible contract for me, especially as a first-time author. And, my track as an author is a little different, because a lot of times before you get published with a publisher, you're often published in magazines. You publish short stories and articles, but I wasn't published anywhere. I'm literally, so people are taking a huge risk on me.
Yeah.
And she was able to still negotiate an incredible contract.
But during those 6 years, right? Like, there's got to be like dark nights and, cold mornings, right? Like, where the fuck am I going? Am I going to finish this? Can you talk about that?
Oh God. Yeah. Sometimes, people in many of these interviews, people are like, "What? Tell us about your process." And I so wish that I could just say, oh yes, I woke up at 5 a.m. every day. I was super disciplined, and I made sure to write down 1,000 words before my morning coffee or blah, blah, blah. But that was so far from the truth. I spent so many nights and mornings in a corner of my room crying, pulling my hair out, just obviously there's so much trauma to unpack in this. And, I'm literally writing this story, and I'm coming out of the darkness still. You know, it's not that I've had like an incredible amount of distance to have processed my past. You know, I had just dropped out of college. You know, I'm still suffering from reeling from the trauma of not being able to see for years, right? And so I had to find a way to write this story. In a way, 7 years sounds like a long time, but in terms of writing a memoir, it's fairly quick because I needed that time to process like an entire lifetime of a difficult life.
What was there a time where you're like, fuck this, I'm not going to be able to finish?
Oh man, like every day.
Really?
Every single
No
day. I mean, you know, I think part of because of the way that I grew up, and just being told that I was always wrong and being a lot of gaslighting. I suffer from enormous self-doubt. And maybe I think self-doubt is just normal in the creative process, but
way.
I think it's like for me it's tenfold because of how I grew up
I still feel that way about
yeah.
myself. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So there wasn't a single day when I thought, oh my God, like I think they made a mistake. I think they, you know, like maybe what I turned into them was a fluke. They somehow saw potential in it, but I'm not actually cut out to be a writer. But you know what? You just keep plugging away. Because at the end of the day, I thought, well, what else can I do? I literally can't do anything else. I majored in writing, so.
Do you still go through that now after that first book is, House of Sticks is out? Do you still go through that as a writer?
Absolutely. You know, I'm embarking on the process of writing a second book. I'm in October, I'm going away to an artist residency, the Malay arts residency, to work on that book. And every day I'm like, oh God, like I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I think it's, you know, imposter syndrome. Like, and I sometimes think, oh, like maybe I was able to get the first book published because it's a true story, but now I'm writing a novel. Like, am I cut out to be a novelist? You know, it's.
So, can we talk about what you're writing?
Yeah, sure. So it's an, I mean, it's an interesting story. It's about an agoraphobic mother-daughter duo. And you know, the daughter is coming of age and is beginning to be really curious about the outside world. But she harbors a lot of fear that her mother has instilled within her of the outside world because they're both agoraphobic. And so she also has a lot of pent up resentment towards her mother for even like, you know, creating this environment for her. But eventually she one day she receives letters from someone. These letters are addressed to her, but she doesn't know who this person is. And so they strike up this correspondence. They become pen pals, and this person basically invites her to tell stories. Now, she one thing her mother another thing her mother has instilled in her is a love of literature. That was always her key to the outside world. And she sort of secretly wants to be a writer. And so she's writing these stories, basically enjoying the correspondence until one day a letter arrives telling her that, you know, this is the last letter I'm going to send you. You're going to have to continue writing these stories on your own. You know, she feels deeply
So cool.
betrayed. She's like, oh my God, you know, I thought we were friends. And she's angry. But one day she realizes that there's an address on the letters and that she can find this person. So that becomes a catalyst for her to step out of her home for the first time and really explore this outside world for real. And I don't know if that was articulate
Yep.
at all, but it's.
Yeah. Hit all the story beats. Your excellent pitch.
Oh.
No, it's beautiful. I love it. I love this story.
Oh, thank you.
Where did you get inspired from the idea of the structure of the story?
You know, that's growing up. So I was really deeply interested in philosophy growing up. And I read this book called Sophie's World by Justine Garder, a Norwegian writer, I believe. And it was sort of like a crash course in philosophy. And it was all about this little girl who receives, you know, this little postcards from somebody completely anonymous. And it turns out a philosopher was corresponding with her and teaching her, basically giving her a crash course in philosophy. And it was a very, the structure to that story is very interesting because she ended up being, she and this philosopher were characters in the book. And they were trying to escape being characters in that book.
Wow.
So I was, oh my goodness. Like I think about that story all the time. And I feel like it's informed a lot of how I view the world. You know, sometimes I feel like there is a puppet master and I'm sort of just the puppet, you know? So I wanted to play around with this epistolary form and see where it'll take me with this particular story.
Yeah. It sometimes, like as artists, we're just sort of like the vessel for the muses, the gods, the.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. And just sort of surrendering to that kind of that principle allows us to kind of like not be so personable and not personable, but not be so precious with the work that we're doing. Cause
yeah.
some another realm of creation that's we're really out of control. It's not in our control.
Yeah, exactly. Especially, you know, when, I don't know if you feel this, but when you get into that flow state, and you're just, it's something, you feel like there's an invisible hand just guiding you along. And sometimes you're not even aware of what you're doing, but what you eventually produce is something that is beautiful, you know? And I live for those moments that really take my breath away. And oftentimes it's like 4 a.m. in the morning when that happens, yeah.
It's dazzling to see what comes out of your fingers when you're like writing and you know, you step back after a few hours after that flow state. To witness it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think of it as like being in the Avatar state, you know, Avatar The Last Airbender. Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of which, I had some moments in the garment business with my parents. I grew up in a factory as well, but not, you know, doing the actual work. When I was 15, they got into the garment side because we were slow in our window coverings business side. And I made deliveries when I was like 14, 15 in a van with my brother. And we'd go drop off stuff to Chinatown. Yeah. And I can recount some crazy stories. And I was wondering, in your experience, because this is something that's not happening anymore. I mean, child labor, maybe, but it's not as normal as it was when we were growing up, right? In immigrant communities. I'm sure it still happens, but were there some stories or some times that you're just like, you're not really in it and you're just like taking a step out and going, wait a minute, this is like weird. This is, your normal kids shouldn't be doing this. Or were you always in the kind of that machine thinking where you're like, oh, I'm just doing what I have to do and this is just part of my responsibility?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was a child, I thought everyone was doing it. Yeah. It was so normal to me.
Yeah.
And I remember in middle school, just my friend invited me to her house, her apartment. And it was the first time that I had gone to somebody else's apartment. And so I walk in and I'm looking around and I ask her, you know, where are all your work materials? And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, you know, like the fabrics, the work materials, you know, like the ties and the cummerbunds. And she's like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I don't know work materials. And so I think it like, it dawned on me like, oh, wow, like other kids don't do this, you know? But even then I didn't realize that it was a problem. You know, in the seventh grade, my social studies teacher, you know, she took us to the auditorium and taught us about like, she put on this documentary about basically child sweatshop labor in Bangladesh, you know? And I'm watching this and I'm just horrified. I'm like, oh my God, how could they put these children to work? You know, it's terrible. And I had no idea. You know, I even started this Against Child Labor Club in middle school, you know, in response to the outrage that I felt. And I was just so far removed from my own reality. And it took me quite a few years to realize, like, you were part of the same, like, you were also a child sweatshop labor, you know? It had a different flavor simply because we were in America, right? So it doesn't register that this is a possibility in a country like America. And yet here I was in Queens, doing child sweatshop labor at the age of three, no less. You know, I started from three and to age of 12, so.
But that being said, though, looking back, would you do it different? If you had a chance to like wave a magic wand, would you not do that? Would you extricate yourself from that 8 years or 9 years of being a child laborer?
That is a great question. I don't know because I feel like so much of what makes a person who they are is, you know, what they experience. And it has taken me a long time to accept who I am and to love who I am. And now that I'm here, you know, I think about all those nights that I spent with my family members,
Yes.
you know, with my brothers on in the
Yeah.
middle of the living room on the floor making these ties and these cummerbunds, and we really developed such a strong, unbreakable bond with one another. And I would not trade that for the world, you
And
know.
that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, exactly. And also, yes, child labor is an inherent evil, but at the same time, it was the only thing that kept, you know, food on the table, a roof over our heads.
Right.
We didn't receive enough government assistance to truly pull us through the hard times. And so we, in a sense, we're very deeply grateful for this sweatshop labor that we were
And
able to find.
reading your book, I just imagine, because I went through sort of like that with the window coverings business with my brother, my mom and dad, and uncles, who was always around people. We were always just being social with the people in the factory. We had these old soldiers that came on the boat wave, and they would eat out of their what we call a gammon. I forget what the English, it's like a three stack container,
Oh, yes, yeah.
the metal. I don't know what it's probably a French word that came in, but it's a big gammon. And they would take everybody, you know, five or six guys would go out to the backyard and take out their gammon. And then we could, you know, they would let us try what their wives prep for them. And, you know, I remember being 8, 9 years old, and, you know, they would eat and then they would smoke and they would sit around and talk shit. Those were fucking precious moments of my life. As I read your book, I thought about those times where like I would never give up those experiences. And it was a tough time, I think, you know, as immigrants, you know, they worked very hard, but there's some beauty in that. There's a just a beauty in that culture that we you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we made the best of what life handed to us.
Yeah.
And you know, here we were doing sweatshop labor, but we were also like, I was playing games with my brothers, you know, with like the buckles, you know, we were trading buckles and you know, using the pieces to make chess pieces sometimes. It was just really, we were able to be creative. And you know, as children, children are just relentlessly curious,
Right.
and they view life through this sort of lens of wonder. Everything is a miracle to us, and so I really wanted to infuse that sense of wonder into our experience, as bleak as it may seem. But we were happy during that time.
Why do you think some writers get signed and some don't? Is it the quality of the writing? Is it thematic things? Is it genre focus? Is it luck? I mean, what in your experience now, after all these years, gets writers signed or gets talent onto the screen or get them onto, you know, producers for to do music? What is it about artists that, in your opinion, gets them to sort of this official place where you get signed and you move on to the next level?
Oh, you know, that's such a good question. I honestly think it's all a crapshoot. Like, you know, it's totally, I think a majority of it is luck because, you know, sometimes we see, you know, I see a lot of literature that gets published and I'm like, how did this get published? And that seems mean to say, but then I'll read, you know, work from people and I think, why is this not published? It's incredible. And so I think there are a lot of factors that play into, you know, how a manuscript is chosen, right, for publication. I think it depends on what's going on in the world at large, right? Like, does this story fit into, you know, what people demand, you know, in the art that they consume? And then it depends on, you know, what agents are looking for, what editor, like their tastes. And then people who are, depends on who you know too, your network, people who are like super savvy in terms of how they navigate social media even. You know, these days, and the landscape has changed drastically from just these past few decades. You know, some agents won't even sign with an author unless they have like a particular platform, right? Mm-hmm. A particular size of the platform. So, but yeah, it's hard to tell what gets published and what doesn't.
Now, you are part of this literary canon, literary, like new writers, not new, but I mean the last decade of guys like Phuc Tran, Saigon, Things We Lost the Water, Eric Nguyen, Fortunes of Jaded Women, it's a new book with Carolyn Nguyen, and of course Ocean and Viet Thanh Nguyen. But I think in order to break into like the real big mainstream where like a lot of people in America or the world is reading, to get the like the bigger numbers, where do you think writers, Vietnamese writers, would be heading to get to like Viet Thanh Nguyen with The Sympathizer? It's cultural, but at the same time there's themes that are like massive, or Ocean Vuong. Like, do you think that we have much longer of a runway in terms of memoirs like yours or Saigon, or do you think you know, now is going to be the new age, like the new book that you're writing? I think it's a wonderful departure from the cultural memoirs, but you know, where do you think we are on the spectrum of like sort of moving out of memoirs about our cultural, you know, past, and moving into like broader waters?
Yeah, you know, I was just at Carolyn Nguyen's book talk yesterday at Little Saigon Creative in Seattle, and she was talking about sort of you know, veering away from talking about trauma, and so I'm really excited to read The Fortunes of Jaded Women. So ready to sink my teeth into it, but I think we're at the very beginning. I think it's starting already. You know, we're healing as a people, and the newer the younger generation are looking at life through very fresh eyes, and so I think the path is already set, or is already being paved for just stories that are addressing broader themes.
I love to hear that. Yeah. Addressing of broader themes. It's so great to hear that from you, and you know, knowing that there are, I mean, we just can't like talk about our own cultural stories forever, but it's definitely needed to heal. And I think a good 20 years of like that sort of, you know, two decades of this continuing work on cultural memoirs, and I ask because I kind of want to move out of that space sometimes, you know. I get burned out, you know, thinking about all this cultural talk, and I want to move into like new stories like what you're writing about, and I can't wait to have you back on, you know, when that book is published, you know.
Thank you so much, and thank you for supporting you know, different voices too. I think it's like I said, you know, I'm really excited about just being a writer at this time, especially being a Vietnamese writer. You know, growing up, I didn't see myself represented, so now I want to be that voice of representation. Yes, I did start with a memoir, and that memoir did address, you know, themes of the war, intergenerational trauma, which I still think it's necessary. It's necessary for that to be an ongoing conversation, right? Because there are just scores of people who still have not healed. So I think there's space for both types of stories, or for all types of stories, so that we can represent the wider spectrum of humanity.
Yeah, and then also, this is another thing that I heard in an interview that you did, was this idea of going back in the past and writing new sort of a new twist or new perspective on historical. So here's what I wanted to ask you. In a previous interview that you did, you spoke about Hai Ba Trưng and attacking that story, right? Like bringing that story to life, which is amazing. But then the Bronze Drum came out, right? So yeah. how do writers know when another writer is working on the same project? And then, you know, if you're so invested, like let's say you did 3 years on that book and you're working on that journey, and then all of a sudden the Bronze Drum comes out and you're working on Hai Bai Jing, where does that put you? And how is there a database? I mean, how do you know what projects are like kind of brewing out there? And, you know, where does that put you as a writer and your time that you invested in a story like Hai Bai Jing?
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to lie. When the Bronze Drum came out, I thought, oh my God, I wanted to be the first person to talk about Hai Bai Jing. But, you know, how many stories do we have about World War II, World War I, the Holocaust? Mm. You know, I think there is this sort of scarcity mindset where there can only be one, you know, whenever you're a person of color or a minority, it's like, oh, there can only be one of this story. And I just refuse to accept that. And so I'm going to tell my story of Hai Bai Jing in my own way. And I hope that there is room for me, you know, or not that I hope, but I will make sure that there is room for me.
That's a great answer.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Answer. Yeah. It's an abundant mindset. It's a beautiful right. answer. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Because I do want to see what the other side of Hai Bai Jing's story is too. And from a female, a Vietnamese female, I want to see it instead, you know, like this came from Phuong Nguyen, you know, a Vietnamese American man. I'd love to see, you know, where it comes from a Vietnamese writer.
I'm really looking forward to it. I'm also looking forward to reading The Bronze Drum. I want to celebrate, you know, Phuong Nguyen's success as well. Mm-hmm. I think there's, like I said, there's room for both.
Great. He did a great job. Knocked it out.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I would love to hear your version one day too. So Lee, thank you so much today. It was such an invigorating conversation and you know, got to get some peeks into the way you think, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like I could have just talked to you for hours. Yes. Yeah, it's such an honor to be on your podcast. I've listened to a lot of your episodes and I've loved them all. Really incredibly thoughtful questions. So thank you for this opportunity. Yeah,
thank you for the kind words. And let's get back on after you get that the second book out. We'd love to hear more about it.
Absolutely. I'll send you a copy as soon as it's, you know, off the presses.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Lee.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.